Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Bristol Festival of Ideas. My name is George Miller, and at this May's festival, I was fortunate enough to get the chance to interview several of the guest speakers. My guest in this programme is Simon Baron-Cohen. Simon is Professor of Developmental Psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and Director of the Autism Research Centre there. His talk at the festival on the 21st of May was called 0 Degrees of Empathy. After the event, I spoke to Simon and began by quoting one of the reviewers on the back of his recent book, also entitled 0 Degrees of Empathy, who said that he seeks to deliver us from evil. That, I thought, was a neat way of summing up his project, given that he feels we need to get beyond a theological concept of evil, lacking as it does any real explanatory power.
That's right. So I use a different concept altogether, which is the concept of empathy, because I think, although the word evil sometimes has emotional force, and so it can express our horror at what somebody else has done of a bad nature, I don't think it's very useful scientifically, whereas what I try to do in the book and in the lecture today was talk about what science has been doing to understand empathy and why some people have more empathy and others have less.
I have to confess, I was watching it all, and I didn't do very well in the eye recognition test. I don't know what the answer to the second one is still. What was the answer to the second one?
Well, the answer to the second one was interested.
I've scored 50%, that's not too good.
So that test is quite tough. You know, I think if we made the test too easy, everybody would get 100%. And that happens if you give people the whole face, that people do much better. But if you just give them the eyes in the face, it makes it sort of more challenging. And part of why we do that is to try and distinguish these different degrees of empathy.
And do you test with auditory cues as well as visual cues to see if people are attuned on other senses?
That's right. So there are different ways that you can empathise, and most of what I was describing today were visual ones, so looking at the face. But there are other ways, such as listening to the voice, listening to intonation, and some of our tests involve just listening to what people are saying to try and judge their thoughts or intentions from their tone of voice.
Well, I'm going to console myself with the thought that perhaps I'd do better on that one. I mean, maybe you could just say what your working definition of empathy is, what components of it are.
Yeah, so my definition of empathy has two components. The first is what we call cognitive, which is the drive to identify what someone is thinking or feeling, so taking someone else's perspective. And the second is what we call affective, which is the emotional response to what someone is thinking or feeling, having an appropriate emotional response. And in the talk, I was really arguing that you need both components to be working to say that somebody has empathy.
And empathy is something which is measurable and can be plotted on a bell curve. It comes out that most of us are somewhere in the middle, and then we have two extremes of highly empathic people and then people who have very low empathy.
That's right. So, in the old days, we might have thought it was just binary or categorical, that you either have empathy or you don't. And I think what's new in the research is showing that there are degrees of empathy, and you can measure it, as you say. So it means that you can't really put people into neat categories. You can't say that anybody this side of the line has a disorder, for example. It seems to be a very seamless spectrum or continuum, and that we're all somewhere on that spectrum.
And is having a low degree of empathy a necessary condition for cruelty? Because you're interested in cruelty, you talk at the beginning of the book about as a child being sort of baffled by hearing about Nazi cruelty and that being something that you've sort of worried away at.
Yeah.
So is a low degree of empathy definitionally necessary in order to inflict cruelty?
Yeah, I mean, for me it is definitional that when someone acts in a cruel way, they've turned off their empathy. Or, for some people, the empathy was never there to begin with. But low empathy by itself doesn't necessarily lead to cruelty. And we know that because there are some groups in the population who have difficulties with empathy, but who don't go on to hurt others. And the clearest case for me is people with autism or Asperger's syndrome. So they have trouble reading faces and reading voices and interpreting people's actions. They don't seem to have so much trouble with machines and systems, so they might be very comfortable with their computer, but all the while find it hard to understand someone else's conversation. So low empathy can just result in avoiding other people or finding it difficult to socialise and make friends.
And clearly, one of the things which people in the audience found most fascinating this afternoon was the interplay between nurture, especially early experience, and the genetic component which you talked about, and then also the cultural aspect. And there seems to be a very complex interplay of those forces which shape our empathic response.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, there are no surprises here. You know, that although what's new is we're looking at empathy, that seems to be the product of the usual suspects, nature and nurture, and the interplay. But I think it is particularly complex because we are finding evidence of genes that play a role. We are finding evidence of early environmental factors. So, for example, children who've been abused or neglected have much more trouble developing empathy later. But equally, people in the audience were quite rightly pointing out that political or social forces can affect your empathy. You know, if you have a new trend in society like vegetarianism, which only really came into Britain in the 50s, you know, that can change the way people think about animals and whether animals have feelings.
It's almost as though society as a whole has a kind of empathic threshold which can be higher or lower depending on circumstances, ideological circumstances or whatever.
That's right. So it reminds us that empathy isn't fixed, although it may be your early childhood and your genetics puts you into a certain band of empathy. At the same time, there's lots of fluctuation, which might be situational because you're tired or stressed, and it might be the result of the particular time that you're born in, that whether your society is sanctioning certain kinds of behaviour.
One thing which I found fascinating, but which you didn't have time to talk about this afternoon, but I wanted to ask you about a little bit, is your suggestion that there should be a category of psychiatric disorders called empathic disorders, which are taken into account in the workings, for example, of the criminal justice system. Because at the moment, a psychiatrist can say someone who has killed her own children is not suffering from psychiatric disorder because her state of mind doesn't conform to any of those described in the manual, the Bible, the psychiatric disorders, and you feel that's sort of aberrant, really.
Yeah, so I looked at that particular case in the book of a woman who'd murdered her two daughters, who was considered by a modern psychiatry as not having any particular psychiatric condition. She wasn't depressed, as far as they could establish, not at the time of the crime, and she didn't have a long-standing personality disorder. And so I thought, well, maybe that means that psychiatry is lacking a category, which I call empathy disorders, because, as we said earlier, it's part of the definition of that if someone can hurt somebody, if somebody can act in a cruel way, their empathy has switched off. And part of what modern neuroscience is showing us is that there are circuits in the brain that allow empathy. So we can sort of infer backwards that if somebody can hurt their own child, probably at the time their empathy had gone down. And when you look at it in that way, instead of wanting to punish the individual, we should perhaps see them as no different to any other medical condition, where you could have a drop in your blood sugar level, and you suffer the consequence of maybe falling into a coma. So you could have a drop in your empathy, which could affect your behaviour towards others.
Which has potentially profound implications, doesn't it? I mean, it would again mean, definitionally, anyone who committed an act of murder had a severe empathic deficit and therefore had to be at that time and had to be. So then what would the implications of that be, do you think, for how they were treated?
Yeah, so the implication is that maybe they shouldn't be seen in the criminal justice system, or not only in the criminal justice system, that maybe they should be seen in the health service, for example. And actually, this is already happening. So Broadmoor, most people think of it as a prison, but actually it's part of the NHS. And although the people who are in there are locked up, so they've lost their liberty, and you know, the legal system has to have a way of signalling that if you cross the line, you lose certain privileges. But nevertheless, it's a therapeutic environment, that the work going on in the psychoward more is not punitive, it's actually compassionate, in seeing that these are individuals whose lives fell apart at a particular point, leading them to do certain, often very bad things, but that we should seek to understand why that happened, rather than judging them for it.
Another very interesting juxtaposition which came up this afternoon, which I wanted to get you to tease out a little bit, was Franz de Waal's work on empathy in higher primates, who resist administering electric shocks to their fellows, and the Milgram experiment in which human subjects were invited, encouraged indeed, to administer electric shocks and seem to have much lower resistance to it. What do you think the difference there is? What's conditioning that response in humans?
It is fascinating. So the monkey experiment was by Masselin, but actually Franz de Waal has observed the same sort of thing in naturalistic settings, that monkeys will show empathy, that's what it looks like, to their fellow monkeys. But you're pointing out that human beings, under certain conditions, can switch off their empathy, particularly if there's a figure of authority that tells them it's okay to do so, like the Milgram experiments. And, you know, maybe that's telling us that actually in human beings there's this extra level of cognition, which is all about our belief system, and that if we believe that what we're doing is sanctioned or is even helping somebody, we're willing to do what people tell us.
Has there been any research on the effects of watching violent films or playing violent video games on one's sort of empathic threshold, whether that is a potentially sort of culturally erosive practice?
Right. Well, it is an active area of research, and the media are particularly keen on it. I'm not particularly convinced that watching or playing violent computer games or watching violent films necessarily leads to translation into action. But I'm not aware of any research which has looked directly at the impact of either viewing or playing those games or media on tests of empathy.
And maybe finally, Simon, an interesting point which came up is the question of whether empathy can be taught or learned or cultivated. It seems to be clear that we don't have a certain question which doesn't vary. It can go up and down according to circumstances. So can it be sort of cultivated?
I think empathy is in some ways no different to any human skill, that the more you practice it, the better you get. The other thing is that you see it changes with age. You know, I think that, you know, we look at our own children and they seem to be struggling with empathy at certain points in their lives. And teenage, you know, the adolescent stereotypically is someone who struggles to understand their parents' point of view. But by adulthood, they do understand it. So you can see developmental changes. And in terms of teaching, certainly we've been looking at the cognitive component of empathy, whether you can teach emotion recognition. And it turns out that you can. So people become more skilled at it if they get a chance to study emotions on a DVD, for example. I don't know whether the affective part of empathy is as easy to teach. But I sort of remain optimistic that with the right methods, people should be able to improve in that empathy.
Is that actually learning empathy, or is that, because you talked about Asperger's patients, Asperger's sufferers, who by brute logic can achieve a sort of moral sense?
Yeah.
It's like coming to a conclusion by a different route. And if you're learning empathy from a DVD, are you learning empathy, or are you learning to sort of replicate the responses which resemble empathy?
Yeah. Well, this is sort of getting at, you know, what's the sort of natural form of empathy versus what, you know, the kind of empathy that might have been acquired unnaturally. Something I'm sort of less concerned with that, because I sort of feel that whether you end up with your moral code through a logical route, or whether you learn to recognise other people's feelings because you've put in a lot of hard work and practice, whatever route you've gone down, the end point might be very desirable for the person and for those around them. But I think that there are still questions about whether, you know, some aspects of empathy might be particularly difficult to acquire if they don't come naturally. And one very, very good example of that is what's called insight, you know, the ability to be aware of your own empathy and, you know, how other people see you.
I was talking to Simon Baron Cohen. That's all for this podcast, but there's plenty more to explore on the festival website at ideasfestival.co.uk, including an audio archive of interviews and, of course, news of forthcoming festival events. Do join me again soon for another Festival Ideas podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.